So they're filling up these detention centers. I do believe they will turn them into concentration labor camps. And they won't only be for migrants, but for any part of the population that's defined as different or a threat to the regime. So we really have to sound the alarm. And we as migration scholars, because what we know, the knowledge we have about who migrants really are and how they build societies and how this has always been part of building society, has to be an alternative narrative that we make loud and clear as we unite with other people who are under attack.
What if migration isn't something that just happens, but something that is made? Welcome to Production Site, the podcast about the societal negotiation of migration. We explore how migration is produced through policies, institutions, and categories. And we ask, what role does migration research itself play in this process?
Welcome to this episode of our podcast Production Site. Today we want to talk about migration research in current times, where we witness rising authoritarianism, anti-migrant politics, and an increasing extreme right in many parts of the world. And we want to discuss what this means for us as migration scholars. My name is Christine Lang. I'm professor of social geography and reflexive migration research at Osnabrück University, and I'm hosting this episode together with my dear colleague Janine Dahinden, professor of transnational studies at the University of Neuchâtel. We are joined today by Nina Glick-Schiller, one of the world's leading voices in migration research. She's emeritus professor of anthropology and was the director of the Cosmopolitan Cultures Institute at the University of Manchester. Her work, for example, on the concept of methodological nationalism or transnationalism, has left a lasting mark on the field. She's currently speaking out loudly against rising authoritarianism and the curbing of migrants' rights. For example, she's co-author of a manifesto entitled The End of Migration, in which she calls on migration scholars not merely to observe the erosion of migrants' rights, but to actively counter these developments. She's also among the founders of a network that seeks to unite migration scholars from around the world who speak out against the dehumanization of migrants and refugees and who work toward a more humane and just world.
So, Nina, many thanks for joining us today for this conversation. And our idea for this podcast is really to focus on your recent publication on the manifesto with the title The End of Migration. And also, of course, we are very much interested to know more about your initiative of this Migration Scholars Global Solidarity and Resistance Network.
We read your manifesto, of course, as many, and we'd like to ask you first, it has this provocative title, The End of Migration as We Know It. Maybe you can briefly elaborate a bit on what you mean by this.
First, I'd like to say it's not just my manifesto. It was a joint production, and I do think that scholarship is always collective, but we don't always give it credit. And especially when we're coming from different places and different positionalities, when we come together and we see a global trend, it's a form of scientific verification in a way. So Michael Bass had been working in Singapore, and he worked with construction workers and migrant workers in the Gulf states who were building sports arenas. And I had been working in the US and in Germany and in the UK. And we came together at the Max Planck Institute of Social Anthropology in Halle, and we began to see that we were seeing a similar trend. Those conversations is where this manifesto came from. When we began to write it, which was in 2022, it was provocative, looking at a trend where the kind of migration that migration scholars had been studying, where people lived transnationally, built lives in more than one place, built communities in more than one place, was coming to an end because the regulation, the migration regime, the government regulation of migration and the corporate entrance into surveillance was changing and growing. And this would stop the way we were seeing migrants live their lives in a dramatic and important ways. world disruptive ways. So that's why we called it a manifesto. It was sort of a wake-up call. Migrants are now become the enemy, the invaders, and migration is ending, and migration scholars really must speak out.
Thank you for this short elaboration. And I would like to push you a bit more towards this question, what has really fundamentally changed. First, in this manifesto, you describe a kind of standard Western model of migration regime, which you say have importantly shaped migration scholarship, migration, settlement, citizenship. You put this like a kind of a model where also migration research worked upon. But I'm not sure this was really the model. Isn't this rather a US position? Like we had in Europe, we didn't have this migration settlement citizenship regime often. I mean, jus solis doesn't exist in Europe. We had the so-called guest worker regime, which has been very precarious in many countries, like in Germany or in Switzerland. I think we fully agree with you that the situation is really currently changed. But what exactly was it?
I think we're entering a new historical conjuncture, mm-hmm. a combination of political, economic, cultural, religious, social forces mm-hmm. that are recombining to legitimate an authoritarian capitalism, an illiberal kind of governance. And migration is the cutting edge. And I think it reminds us to step out of our own particular paradigms and that have contrasted the U.S. to Europe. I don't agree with you that Europe was that different. I think in both places, people have always migrated. And from the time of, if we start with World War II and the post-war moment, Europe was rebuilt by migrants. Most of them stayed, but the fact that they were migrants was forgotten. So the difference is what's remembered and forgotten in the dominant narrative, not the history of migration. People came to Europe. There were displaced people from Eastern Europe. There were refugees who fled the power of the Soviet Union. There were labor migrants from Southern Europe who moved north. And there were colonial migrants from both the Caribbean and South Asia. And they all came, and most of them actually stayed, enough to make it a significant part of the population. The percentages are just about the same, 3 or 4% of the whole population. But U.S. is seen as a nation of immigrants, and Germany's is not. That's part of the way in which all the refugees, the people who fled, the ethnic, so-called ethnic Germans, fled and then were assimilated, actually. So what you've got is different narratives, not different processes. But whether you had a narrative of assimilation or a narrative of disappearance, what's changing is people are now not able to move and settle. That doesn't mean labor migration will change. I think there will be labor migration, again, part-time, rightless migration that drives, as part of driving down the labor standards and the industrial regulation across the board. We're at a conjunctural transformation. At the moment of conjunctural transformation, the old order changes and the new is not yet born. And agency matters a lot, including our agency as migration scholars. That's what's in the manifest, and that's what I'm arguing. And dispossession, which has always gone on as part of capitalism, takes different shapes and different modes of realization in different times. And the mode of realization that the billionaires of the current moment are pushing toward is this rightless, anti-democratic governance.
But I think the last point, it's very important because this authoritarian moment, this anti-democratic moment, it's the rule of law, which is not respected anymore.
Exactly. And it's not like these things haven't happened before. I mean, we're sitting here in Germany and we know that the taking over of a democracy and the institution of a fascist regime has certainly happened in the past. It happened at a time, a different conjuncture in terms of where the rest of Europe was and the U.S. was, including its manufacturing base. And it happened in a moment of crisis, a moment of crisis in capitalism, depression all through the West. And Germany chose one path and the rest of the world chose another path, not particularly justice-friendly, but more formally democratic. It's helpful to see what the different conjunctures are. So there was conjunction coming off World War II, where Europe and North America and part of the Americas embraced a democratic face and in competition with the Soviet Union. And in that competition, there was a continuing granting of rights, a form of social democracy, even in the United States, but more thoroughly in Europe, where workers' rights were respected to some degree. It was not perfect. I don't want to be nostalgic about it. In the U.S. was respecting rights, human rights all around the world, even while there was extreme segregation in the U.S., extreme racial segregation. So there was a big gap between the narrative and its implementation, but there were these policies and at that Cold War moment. And it was built on industrial capitalism. And that industrial capitalism started to come into crisis at the end of the 60s, spurred by national liberation, the end of colonialism. And at that moment, a new conjuncture starts to develop, a neoliberal one, the one where most people who at this university and most people alive have lived through. And this was a conjunction with a different cultural persona of individuality, of selfies, of individual rights, of individual freedoms, individual right to consume, and a different kind of capitalism that was more and more privatizations. And all the social institutions that were built during the post-World War II social democratic moment were taken apart. So there was more in some places than others, more slowly in Germany, in fact, than in other places. But the guarantee of secure labor has slowly been taken away, as has the industrial base, which was globalized. And as that's happened, more, as I said, at a different pace, because the thing about a conjunctural analysis, it's not a period. It's not fixed. It's not uniform. It varies across time and space. So how it comes, neoliberalism in China was different than neoliberalism in Germany was different than neoliberalism in North America. But everywhere it happened in some form with this cultural dialogue of the individual mobility and the actual fact of a movement of wealth to the top and a growth of precarity for more and more of the population. And now that conjuncture is coming to an end. There was such a gap now in wealth between this billionaire class, this 1%, which owns most of the wealth, and the rest of the people who don't, that the billionaire class is starting to realize that the way in which power is configured in China and Russia already can happen around the world. Basically, they can become the government. As I said, it hasn't been done yet, but there's a direction for them to directly merge corporations and governance, finance and governance, AI and governance, so that they control more directly. And that means taking away the kind of rights that developed during social democracy, the alteration and a restructuring of culture, of social institutions and political institutions, as well as the economy. And here we are.
Thank you so much for this, because this is not in a manifesto. And I think this is very important that we could make you talk about this.
Yeah. Maybe also to add this perspective on rights. You mentioned the social rights, but also what we can observe is very much a change in the human rights regime, also kind of which has been established in a certain historical moment and has had its historical conjuncture, but now related to this rise of nationalist, populist, right-wing policies, that this whole idea of there is something like an international human rights regime seems to erode. And I wonder how you connect this also, because in your manifesto, you make very clear that we have to get away from this traditional categorizations in migration research, labor migrants, refugees, but we have to see how there's very similar situations that they face and whether this rights perspective is actually what connects these situations, that we have an erosion of the social rights that have been established at a certain times, but also an erosion of human rights that go beyond social rights of workers, but also concern then the displaced person, refugee, the understanding that they are bored, that there's something like asylum. So whether you see the connection there on this rights perspective.
Yes, I've been tracing it. I've been writing this paper, which tries to put this together. And the human rights and the right of asylum is very interesting, because right after World War II, it was a narrative that develops within the United Nations and with building on the four freedoms that FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, had put out as a goal in terms of justification for World War II, to rally public support. And it built on the freedom of speech and the freedom of belief. And it gets taken into the Declaration of Human Rights. But in the beginning, right after World War II, they really were only talking about Europe. They only applied refugee rights to people fleeing the Soviet Union and to displaced people. This was a rights regime that applied to Europe. And it's exactly as the conjuncture changes to neoliberalism that we get the rights regime applied globally. And the rights of asylum really get instituted and procedures get instituted so people can come from Africa or Latin America and claim asylum elsewhere. And that's a very interesting connection, because at the very moment that the economy is privatizing public things, it's also creating this, at the same time, culturally, we get this creation of this international rights regime. And we have to ask why. Why at the moment of taking of rights, in fact, of people in what's called the West, the Western democracy, why at that very time do we have this rights regime promulgated around the world? I think that there's a connection between human rights, humanitarian work, and security work and the construction of a national security state. We see this happening dramatically after 9/11. So it's a process, but it really comes from the very idea that you have to have a whole structure, a UN structure, a government structure to decide who is really a refugee and who's just a labor migrant and therefore doesn't have a right to come into the free world anymore, right? Because they're just a labor migrant. And this categorization, which migration scholars contributed to, legitimated, got funded to do, created whole fields, journals about refugee studies here, transnational migration there, this kind of distinction becomes the basis then for developing an increasing rejection of asylum seekers on the basis that they're not really asylum seekers, and then a criminalization of people who migrate. So we can see the progression, and how it happens starts to develop during the neoliberal conjuncture as people's actual social rights and a sense of social good gets taken away, and public programs are defunded, and money is moved into integration programs for refugees. And that's why the publics in so many places got so angry, because their programs, their decent schools, their decent hospitals, their affordable housing gets taken away just as the money is put into supporting asylum seekers.
There is another aspect which I found quite interesting, at least when it comes also to social science. I mean, there was this a long tradition of these critical humanitarian studies, right? I mean, like Didier Fassin, Miriam Dickdin saying, I mean, this whole humanitarianism is actually, it's a moral economy based on compassion and taking away rights. So this would basically nicely fit with what you have been saying. This would be the second juncture we have been talking about. But now we are scholars, again, we are here because there is no money anymore for humanitarian aid. So we have been critically analyzing something which was a critical movement or process. But what are we doing now? We can even not criticize this anymore because most countries on the planet now withdraw their money for other countries, they withdraw humanitarian aid I'm living next to Geneva. Geneva is empty. You know, I mean, these international organizations in Geneva, these humanitarian organizations, they don't have money anymore. So again, it's we criticized as scholars. We clearly saw, we made this critical analysis, but what are we doing now?
That's why I say we have to be activists. We always should have been activists. We wouldn't have ended up in this position, maybe. Yes, in the United States, when Trump came into power the second time, he issued a list of words that you can no longer say. One of them is immigration. The United States, which has been a country built on immigration, suddenly we can't talk about migration. We can't talk about racial injustice. We can't talk about women is another word that's on that list. What we've got now, in fact, is migration industries that are based on detaining and deporting migrants. So part of the cutting edge is an attack on migrants. The economic part of that is that it's very profitable. The billionaires profit from criminalizing migrants and from borders. And these detention centers, there's $45 billion being put in to detention centers in the U.S., and there's already about 70,000 people in detention centers, with the justification that they're rounding up criminals when most of the people, 70%, have absolutely no record. And if the others do, it's a traffic violation like a headlight. These are not big criminals. So they're filling up these detention centers. I do believe they will turn them into concentration labor camps. And they won't only be for migrants, but for any part of the population that's defined as different or a threat to the regime. So we really have to sound the alarm. And we as migration scholars, because what we know, the knowledge we have about who migrants really are and how they build societies and how this has always been part of building society, has to be an alternative narrative that we make loud and clear as we unite with other people who are under attack.
Maybe you can talk a bit more about how migration scholars should react to these changes that you describe, both in the way they do research, also the kind of categories and concepts scholars use, and, well, in the way that they also engage in activism.
Well, first I want to say something about the categories we've used. I mean, we were part of creating this narrative that legitimates these attacks. I do think so. I don't think that most people meant to do that. I think migration scholars, I've met them from all over the world, are mostly a very caring sort, humanitarians, in fact. But we did make migrants very much into others. We really legitimated that they needed to be integrated in some way. The dividing, and this is a way, this is a form of methodological nationalism, to see the dividing line, the major dividing line of identity and interests and culture between migrants and non-migrants, when in fact people have multiple identities. People identify, you know, in terms of age, gender, region, profession, tastes in music, tastes in food, that don't have anything to do with the boundaries of a nation state. So, and that's why when migrants show up someplace, they start to become social of the fabric. They're parents, they're workers, they relate to what's going on, and they build social ties. And that's really coming out now in the United States, because when they start rounding up people, then the people who were saying, oh, yes, get rid of the criminal gangs, you know, sure, take them away, start to say, wait a minute, those are my neighbors, my friends, the children in my child's class, my coworkers, our local political representatives, our local university faculty, our doctors. And suddenly they begin to see, first of all, we see two things right at this moment, how migrants have become part of the society. And it's not just in the U.S. You go to any German city, you see small businesses, you see healthcare professionals, you see people from all different backgrounds working together. You see part of the workforce has a migrant background. That's what you see. Even in the East. And those small businesses very often revitalize the city, become hold down property, become part of keeping any kind of commerce in a small city or a small town. They're vital. So when you start rounding them up, you really destroy the local economy. That's what happened in Minneapolis. They destroyed the local economy when they started rounding up migrants. So our research didn't make that clear. Our research, by just looking at the both newly arrived and the migrants, wasn't processual, didn't have a sense of time and change. We were paid to look at migrants as a social problem, so we treated them as a social problem rather than a social solution, which is what they are to many small cities and towns, and to countries that need more population. The major problem, the real one of the contradictions is that in the U.S. and Canada and all through Europe, there's a population problem. There's not enough people. They're not, people aren't reproducing. I'm saying all this because we have only when we cut through those categories can we see how we can organize, how we can see how we can really build unity. For migration scholars, it means stop talking just to migration scholars. Talk to everybody else, your neighbors, the people, you know, whoever, however you relate within your city or town, that's who you should be talking to, your friends, because only when we have this larger conversation about what's happening in the world and the nature of the conjuncture and how an attack on migrants is an attack on all of us, the fabric of our society and the right to have rights, can we start to build this movement, and it's urgent because the crisis is now.
Well, I think we all agree with your analysis, but I think the situation is even more complicated because this V of migration scholar you're talking about has been put into question since 15 years at least. I mean, there are so many social scientists, migration scholars who criticize, among other me, but also others, exactly this kind of categorization that within research we're reproducing kind of a migrantized worldview. And there have been border studies. There have been activists doing participatory research. And what you basically say we need to do, I feel like it became a movement much larger the last 10 years than it was ever before, such that what I would call mainstream migration research is not really mainstream anymore nowadays. You can observe this, for instance, in IMISCO. At this huge conference, it will change. The conversations we have within IMISCO changed these last 10 or 15 years. But we are still in this situation that you described so well in this manifesto, mm-hmm. that it is a critical juncture. And yes, we can talk to others, but they don't listen to us.
But the moment is now different. I mean, there have been migrants' rights demonstrations before, but now everyone's in the streets together. Millions. It's not enough, but it's an indication of the possible. The right stole the moment, stole the anger, and people really sort of continued the facade of liberal democracy and said, you know, well, just vote and everything will be fine, without really speaking to this growth of this billionaire class. So, and migration scholars, whatever you say, we didn't speak to these larger class issues. We didn't speak to the nature of capitalism. Now it's in the streets. I mean, and this mass movement of anger on the right, now there's a possibility to build a mass movement to build a more just society. I won't even say on the left, a movement to understand the rage that built the right and to turn it around. We need to seize this moment now, is what I'm saying.
On the other hand, I wonder, does it need a Trump and some years of Trump until we get there? Because if we look at the developments in European countries, in Germany, but also Switzerland, we are not yet at this stage that we are in the US, but we also don't see thousands of people on the street demonstrating for migrant rights or against some things that are going on. So my impression is rather that it's still, at least from the German perspective, at the moment, it works quite well to scapegoat certain people or to say 80% of Syrians should go back to Syria now that there's a new regime yeah. going there. So, and there seems to be not much rise against that. So we see the AfD vote increasing. So do we need to get up to a moment where, for example, in Germany, the AfD has won the
It's about to happen.
National elections.
It's about to happen. I mean, we just need to be a little, the more preparation, the better. If they're saying 80% of the people of the Syrians can go back to Syria and they start rounding them up, what are we going to do? And these are going to be the neighbors, the businesses, the community members, the school. These children, these families have become part of Germany. They're, you know, they have not been just sitting there collecting benefits, although they say this. They've actually been working in the worst jobs. When they round them up, it sends ripples through the economy. And we have to learn. That's why we had Migration Scholars Network had a program, Learn from Minneapolis. This was a global program. And we had 5 scholar activists from Minneapolis who we didn't name because they're under direct threat and they have migrant background. And they described how people are mobilizing, basically forming small groups, signal groups to protect their neighbors, block by block by block. So because they start to see people just disappearing, and this is what it means to say that the Syrians can go home. And this is what it means when the EU just said that they can deport people, externalize deportation, and create concentration camps in Eastern Africa. And people have to decide whether they want their neighbors and local businessmen and the local Vietnamese restaurant or whatever, suddenly, who might well have an undocumented person chopping vegetables, whether they want to see that business closed and their local restaurant taken away. As I said, conjunctures don't happen in the same place, same way, and at the same time, but they are interconnected. And it's clearly that people have been learning from Trump The EU has been learning from Trump. The European right has been learning from Trump. And they don't just passively learn. Steve Bannon comes and organizes people. Steve Bannon goes to Latin America and organizes. They're developing a global movement. We have to, too. And migration scholars have a role to play.
Maybe the last part of this conversation could be to turn around this network you created, so this Migration Scholars Global Solidarity and Resistance Network. So what does this network do? What did you do concretely? And are you somehow connected to other initiatives in this field?
Yes, I don't want to overblow it. It's just one effort among many. One of the problems with migration scholars is we tend to, because we get funded within our nation state around national policies, we can be very nation state oriented. Even if that's not our own political orientation, that tends to be our knowledge base and where we pay attention to the most. So a handful of us, migration scholars, initially Bella Feldman Bianco and I, she's a migration scholar in Brazil and an old friend, and even older than I am, we kept saying to each other, somebody has to do something. And we finally, last spring, said, well, nobody's doing anything, so here we it'll have to be us. And we started to contact migration scholars that we knew around the world, and we wrote a manifesto. We wrote a statement saying now is the time to organize and to speak globally because we're facing a global situation. And we have to protect migrants and migration scholarship because so that migration scholars will continue to see migration as a social good and not just go along with the flow and get funded to rejoice at deportations and detention. So we put together this statement, and we had some prominent migration scholars from different parts of the world sign it as initiators. Now we have 450 or more people who have said they want to be active members of this network, not just sign something. I'm sure all of us are signing things all the time, but actually participate in actions. And then the question was, what kind of actions can we take? And we decided to learn from the teach-ins in the 1960s, but also make them teach-outs, because those were very university-oriented, and we felt we needed to speak out and speak publicly and find public forums and unite with other people. We want to talk to each other, because we felt that one of the things that happens is that people look at the news and they say, well, I don't really like it, but everybody else seems to be going along. Just as you said, well, all these people want to deport the Syrians. I don't think they actually do, but there hasn't been a way of actually, there's only the right mobilizing, and they haven't had a chance to sit with other people and say, do you think that's right? Not really. Well, I don't think that's right either. That's the kind of thing we wanted to do. We have this website that links together various migration initiatives and publishes them and promotes them. There's a detention center group, documents the number of detention centers all over the world. There's all kinds of activity.
I have another question on this network, because when you describe these whole conjunctures, these changes, you made a very strong point that there are broader societal developments and where the way that migration and migrants are dealt with is just part of, but actually all populations are, or people are affected by this. And you also described that we need this larger conversation and saying that the attack on migrants is an attack on all of us because it concerns so many fundamentals of how we understand and want to have society working. So in this network, are there also ideas to connect with other initiatives or to make this actually broader claim about very fundamental changes on, for example, questions of labor and work, how this is organized or how cities are structured or questions of internal displacement, homelessness or housing markets, or whatever. We can think about so many aspects where these developments play out. So is this network somehow also connected to other initiatives or do you start from the migration lens?
Well, we've taken on the task of helping organize all these migration scholars that have developed all over the world. When I started studying migration, there weren't any migration scholars, basically. Definitely not in anthropology, and really they did demography if they were in sociology. And neoliberalism produced migration studies, migration journals, migration institutes, and hundreds of doctorates in migration. So we thought we would mobilize those, but we're certainly, our members are also active in many other ways. I have to point out that Elise and Tricia are the ones who've been doing the website, and everyone at this moment is, particularly in the U.S., is very overstressed because bad things happen every day. Sometimes it feels like every minute.
Thank you so much. I mean, it was really interesting. And thanks for giving us the time to reflect with us on these issues. And actually, I'm really pleased to hear an optimistic voice, because you are a kind of an optimistic voice, and they are rare currently. We all feel a bit overwhelmed and helpless. And I think that's also when these kind of networks come into play and play really a crucial role to they can unite people and bring us together. So many thanks for this as well.
Can I just say, it's the people of Minneapolis and small towns that are making me optimistic, because when you see that, when they see danger and they see armed masked men, instead of running away, they run toward it to protect their neighbors with a whistle. And you know it's not just happening there. It's happening in small towns. And when small towns say, get together and say, we don't want a concentration camp in our city, no way. Small Republican towns in the South are doing this. Then you see this is possible, but we can't sit back and be pessimistic.
Janine, we just heard Nina call upon us as migration scholars and as citizens to not simply sit back and give in to pessimism, but to act and actively counter current trends of eroding migrants and human rights. So let's take this as a starting point to reflect on our role as migration researchers in these current times, and how we can and should speak up, and what we can take away from our conversation with Nina. And I would suggest actually to take our 3 points related to what we just discussed with Nina and to go a bit further on these. One point is the positionality of research and the impossibility of doing unpositioned research. And the second point is the idea of what is actually activism and speaking out loud and how we can understand this and do this. And the third point would be the responsibility of migration scholars in the usage of categories. So what do you think?
Oh, that's great. Thanks a lot for suggesting these 3 points. And I really think that in Nina's talk or in the podcast, we really can go back to what she said while discussing the 3 points. Would you like to start introducing the first point?
Yes. Question of positionality. So, of course, we work a lot on this in our reflexive approaches to migration research. And I think we can agree that there is nothing like a neutral, objective migration research that is not political somehow or not situated in social and political environments and debates. So that actually also being affirmative or simply uncritical regarding a political context is a political standpoint. What do you think?
Well, I mean, I think it's always very bizarre, isn't it, that if you're not making visible your position or the perspective, the position you're talking from, it's kind of interpreted as being a neutral position.
Yeah.
And I think this is really bizarre. So every time you clearly make transparent from where you're talking, you are considered to be not objective. And I think there's a twist here which doesn't work, because, I mean, I'm also coming from gender studies, and feminist scholars since a long time, actually, they thought about this issue. And Harding, for instance, she argues that objectivity gets even stronger when you really make transparent from which position you're talking. And I think she has a point in this, and I think that's very important. That's also why, in my eyes, we need to be careful with terms like activist. because I think activist is it's not really able to grasp all the positions we have when we speak out as migration scholars.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So I also think the term activism is very negatively connotated. I think that adds to that. And if we start from the idea or from our understanding that there is nothing like unpositioned research, so being like labeling those who make this transparent as activist and as not being actually objective, that it's actually, as you just said, it's the opposite. So kind of better research, I don't know how to call it. I absolutely agree with you that the term activism does not grasp all the activities that are related to this or that we can put under the idea of speaking out loud, so which already starts with teaching. So I think one of my most important everyday way of speaking out is teaching also bachelor students, which do not study migration research, but other topics, but kind of creating a political understanding of the world and point them to some developments and do this in the role of a teacher. And of course, relating this to analytical concepts, but with the whole aim to make them understand better social realities, which always involves a critical viewpoint. So, and you're also very much involved in other kinds of activities, which are not obviously labeled as activism, but take up this role of speaking out loud.
I think I very much liked that Nina, she used this term, to speak out loud. And I think actually using this term, we can kind of disentangle everything we do and every role, these different roles actually we have also as migration scholars. I mean, you talked about one, a teacher. When I give interviews in media, I'm an expert, which is a different role. When I'm invited to argue with right-wing party stakeholders, I even have a different role.
Yes, yeah.
So I think that you never would say that I'm an activist when I talk to journalists. But I think this is also a way of speaking out. I think we are social scientists. We critically analyze societies. That's one of the fundamental issues of social science and hence also of migration scholars.
Yeah. Yeah. And this comes with different audiences, as you just said. And we speak out loud differently towards different audiences. It is important to have this plurality of approaches and voices and also different kind of strategies to transmit our scholarly-based, research-based knowledge to further audiences and connect this to current social and political developments.
Yeah, I fully agree with this. And because we often hear that people are not listening to us. And I think maybe this is right, maybe it's not right, but it's correct or not correct. But what is definitely sure, or I think what is really important is, as you said, to speak out to different forms of audiences and having different roles. And it's not about making a hierarchy between these different roles and positions that go together. So I think activists are not, let's say, less objective than are migration scholars consultancy with politicians, for instance. I think these are different ways of feeling this role of speaking out.
Yeah, but I think what we can take, or what I personally take from our conversation with Nina, is to be much more aware of this role of speaking out loud and maybe reflect much more on how we do this in different settings towards different audiences, maybe also being more self-confident that this is a part of our role. And use these settings and fora to also kind of combine our research-based perspectives with a critical analysis of current social environments, and also help others, help our audiences to better see certain developments that maybe they have not so much reflected upon. I think this really helps to think about this speaking out loud, as you said, to see this as a part of our role as scholars and teachers, but also as citizens in a situation where some fundamentals of a liberal democracy become eroded.
I fully agree. I think it's even more important than ever to be speaking out, also to contribute to democratic debates, to bring in arguments, and also to make very clear that opinions are not the same as arguments. And I really think we have a crucial role to play here, in particular at the current times, which are highly problematic, as Nina addressed very nicely.
Yeah. And I think it's also important what she starts, or they started, this collective started with doing a network to be much more connected on this, and also exchange with others about our different approaches and maybe also challenges we encounter when doing this, which can be kind of the kind of activism and that this scholar network that Nina has initiated is doing, but also other forms. So we see this much more also as a collective task and exchange on this.
I think that's a very important point you said here. I think this the idea of collective solidarity and also of exchange, I feel like this in current times, this is really necessary. And again, for this, I think we need these different audiences, these different roles, etc., in speaking out.
Yeah.
And it's also our responsibility, I think, as migration scholars, clearly.
Yeah, definitely. And also, also to use our role, which is maybe somehow more stable, still more stable than those of other people working in the field and as practitioners who often face kind of also as currently in Germany, for example, cut down in budgets for civil society associations and who also rely on allies and kind of, for example, research to address some points and maybe have some support in voicing their perspective. So I think it's also kind of when we think about solidarity and creating connections, it's one thing is among scholars, but also going beyond that and seeing us as also our responsibility and in connecting with other people who might need this support even more so currently.
Yeah, I fully agree. And there the role of activists, of so-called activists, to go back to this quite narrow term, is still very important, I would say.
So maybe let's move to a further important point that also Nina has addressed in the conversation we had with her. Actually, the responsibility of us as migration scholars in how we use categories. So as Nina has said, so migration scholars have also contributed to make migrants into others. So we are also part of this whole process that we are now criticizing. What do you think?
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, there are a lot of scholars criticizing this meanwhile. And well, I think the important thing is we all need categories. I think we agree about this. This is a psychological issue. We cannot give sense to the world and be in the world without categorization. But the question is, how do we address these migration-related categories in a reflexive way? No? So like, for instance, this distinction between migrants and non-migrants. I mean, we need really to address this distinction, to deconstruct it and reconstruct it. And I think there are a lot of scholars who really the last 10, 15 years came up with many suggestions how we can deal a bit differently with these categories, be it by demigrantization, be it by being interested in how and when and where and through which technologies people become migrantized in the first place and others not. So I think there is a lot going on here and we should not stop doing this.
We should not stop, and it's also a process in our everyday research work. So it's also, it's not an easy task to always kind of keep thinking about the categories we use, especially because we also have to use some categories in the field when we are doing empirical research. We cannot come with our abstract theories. Of course, we need to speak in the language of the people that we talk to. But then this constant reflection on not conflating the categories we meet there, we also kind of use in our everyday languages. But then with the categories of analyses, once we look at the processes that we study there, so to reflect on this in all stages of our research process. I think, as you say, it's a process both in our own research, but then, of course, an ongoing process in the discussion on how we best deal with this and what we can make with this.
Yeah, and I think you raise an important point. Of course, when I talk to politicians, I can talk about migrantized people, or I can just simply speak about migrants. But internally, I have this distant that I know. I say migrants because it's a strategy to connect to people to discuss something, to bring them at the end of the day to think about something. I want to think them differently, maybe, or for once, to open up their horizon. So it's not about not using the categories, but it's about not reproducing them in order to not reproduce very fundamental hegemonic power relations and forms of violence. I think that's important. And this is a topic that it always comes up with students. They're really afraid now at times of using these categories. They're afraid of making mistakes. They're afraid of reproducing hegemonic power relations. And I think it's good to be afraid, but we still can use it because we already have this small moment of distance, of analytical distance, and use these categories also in a strategic way, I think, in order to make people think about other things, in order also to make alliances and solidarities and so on.
I'm not sure if it's good to be afraid, if I would share this. I think it's good to be aware that there is something with language, but to be afraid to speak, then to say something, and also bears the possibility to speak about something. So I prefer students who maybe uncritically start just saying what they think, and then we can slowly first talk maybe about content and then about language, than having students who don't dare to speak out anything because of kind of, well, we encounter another problem, this kind of wokeism, negative connotation of all that has to do with being aware of the language that we use, that this is then also something that brings people apart then together.
Of course, I agree with you, but I think the thing what I wanted to say with being afraid is this means they feel, oh, something is going on here. So now let's tackle it. Everyone has the right also to say things and to make mistakes. That's not my point. But that's a first step to be able to be reflexive. So I think we basically agree. Yeah. We just phrased it a bit differently.
Yeah. And I can also nicely relate this actually to what we're currently doing in our collaborative research center production of migration, where the idea of reflexivity and reflecting of our categories is very, very important. And even if we think that we have actually somehow reflected on our objects of study and the categories we use, we have like our fellow colleagues who come with maybe different also disciplinary perspective and make us reflect again about how this is still very much situated and very much kind of a narrow understanding of what we're actually doing here. So I think this reflexive process needs a lot of collaboration also, to have always others who point us to the own biases and blind spots of our thinking.
Well, reflexivity is never done, I would say. Something which has to be established and re-established and changes, and it's a never-ending task, but it should also not be our only task. I mean, again, let's go back to this idea of to speak out. I think reflexivity and speaking out should not get into competition. I think it should be done in parallel, basically.
Yeah, that's true. And I think this is a very good final sentence for our podcast too. And I would like to close this and thanking Nina again for the opportunity to have this inspiring conversation with her. It's so impressive to see how she's still so much active and involved in scholarship and in creating these networks, in activism and speaking out loud against current rising authoritarian movements and anti-migrant politics. I think we both wish, and we all wish, that we could be so active after a long career as Nina Klickschiller is.
Thank you for listening to Production Side, the podcast about the societal negotiation of migration. If this episode made you think, subscribe and spread the word. You can find all credits, sources and further links in the show notes and at producingmigration.org. Production Side is produced by the Collaborative Research Center Production of Migration at Osnabrück University, funded by the German Research Foundation in collaboration with Podcast Fabrik Bielefeld. New episodes are available wherever you get your podcasts. Until next time, and until then, what's being produced right now?